Greetings, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Way of the Showman, where we view the world through the lens of showmanship. I am Captain Frodo, and I will be your host and gracious guide along the way. And today, we are back with another interesting conversation between me and my most common podcast host, Jay Gilligan, an in-depth thinker and exceptional performer. And his wife is from Finland. So during the holiday season, during Christmas, I did a season called Tsigaboom, which was a production put on by Circus Finlandia, and I had an excellent time there performing together with the same troupe of performers that I perform with during the summer in Dyreparken in Kristiansand, which I've talked a little bit about. And anyway, I was there in Helsinki for Christmas. Jay Gilligan was in Helsinki for Christmas. So lo and behold, we managed to carve out some time away from our families and away from the birthday hassle. We sat down and we had a few conversations. In my mind, I think of these as the Helsinki conversations. And we spoke about widely varying topics. And on the first day, Jay, which is the interview chat, it's not an interview at all, it's a chat. We had just been both watching some videos. Danny De Ortiz, an amazing card magician from Spain, we had watched him do his act and fool Penn and Teller on Fool-Os, and it was amazing. And then we watched a Magicians Only clip that was put out by Vanishing Ink, a magic store, about where he talks for 3 hours or more about how he managed to fool Penn and Teller, and he goes into some in-depth deep theory and methods and stuff. And we talk about Danny D'Artiza and we talk about magic. So for all you magicians out there, and I know there's a bunch of you out there who are regular listeners, this is Captain Frodo and Jay Gilligan talking about magic.
I have a question. I have two questions for you, man.
You have two questions for me.
Yeah.
All right. Quick and short, nice and
straight. Oh, yeah, it's going to be easy.
Yeah, yeah. Is it multiple choice?
It's going to... Yeah, I mean, we're going to... Yeah, this 2 minutes, this will be over. Don't worry, 1 minute per question. No, so you watched some of this behind the scenes of Danny De Ortiz, of his Fool-Us act.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we haven't talked about that yet.
No.
So I had a couple of questions related to that.
Yes.
So we talked a little bit about Danny De Ortiz and his performance, his style and his techniques and methods. But I was trying to think what's kind of the main... Well, just to back up for a second, the main thing we talked about was this idea of, which we don't need to get stuck on now, was this idea of other magicians watching these videos and saying, sure, Danny can achieve his effects using these methods, but I can't also achieve... Remember we had that conversation where
that's right.
Oh, it's not relevant to me and therefore it's not worth my time to engage.
And this is just to catch everyone up. This is related to something which is peculiar to magic, whilst in juggling or in variety or whatever, where I am. There is no videos or lectures where somebody tells you how to do the magnet club act, and you go, you do this, and you do this follows this sequence, and this is why, and then this is how you book the gig to sell the magnet club act that you do.
It's a magic culture.
So the magic culture thing, and part of it is, of course, because there are secrets involved, so there are methods and stuff that you might not, or in a really good magic trick or a magic act, like with Danny D'Artiza's Fool-Us act, you are looking at that and you're going like, every now and then I go, I can see what's going on here, but what's going on with, how does he get the guy to say, what do you want? Do you want one, two, or three, or four? And then the guy says four, and he wants him to say four, and then you see him in separate recordings, and the people just say what he wants him to say. How does he make that happen? So...
Yeah, and mostly we were talking about this idea of course, you watch these videos, and for us, or especially for me,
not these coming from teaching videos. Yeah.
Well, it's not even maybe not even a teaching video as much as he was just analyzing his performance in that specific one, right? He was just talking about what he did. He was teaching in one way, but he was really just breaking down his core concepts.
Yeah.
A lot of the feedback from other magicians were like, well, that's not relevant to me. Specifically, like really literally step by step, not relevant to how I perform. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking, well, I'm a juggler, so I'm not a magician looking at this as a step by step guide, like you were saying, but more that I can reflect on his process and I can reflect on his bigger concepts that he's uncovering. And so I was trying to think about Danny D'Ortiz as a whole, and I wanted to ask you a question about him because I had my biggest takeaway from watching his work and from listening to his process is that it does occur to me that the method for his effects really do rely upon his personality. Mm. They really do rely upon his style of delivery. So it's not just what he's saying, but of course how he's saying it. He's very chaotic. He's very sloppy. He appears to be very
That's why I love him so much, because he creates the illusion of being sloppy.
Right.
But what looks like absolutely random, how he interrupts himself to comment on what another spectator might or might not have said, is part of his method. And this is how my act is set up. I create the illusion of chaos, and the illusion of chaos is what makes my magic happen. It makes it seem like it almost can't happen. So it appeals to me. And when he speaks, I'm always listening in an extended way or in an active way. I'm listening to what he is saying, but I am transferring it onto what I am doing. And that's what most people then don't do.
Well, that's good. That's a good setup, because that's a good setup for the question.
Mm.
Because for me, I don't necessarily do chaotic things in the same way, right? So I'm not, first of all, I'm literally not doing magic effects. I'm doing, let's say, juggling effects, whatever that means. And when I do it, we have definitely talked about elements of chaos in my work before, but it's a different kind of thing. It's not chaotic in the technique as much as it is the framework or the stylistic choice or whatever. So when I watch Danny D'Ortiz and I see him do his seemingly chaotic, sloppy chaos as a way to achieve these actually very pinpoint perfect surgical effects in the end, my takeaway is, Danny has an integrated character and technique. And that's the start of the question for you. So this idea that Danny doesn't really separate his character or how he acts. He doesn't separate it from his technique. He doesn't say, well, I'm going to do magic like this and then do a beautiful card flourish, but I'm going to act like I can't remember what comes next.
Mm.
What's integrated is the actual way his technique works is exactly because of who he is as a character. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I find that for me as the biggest takeaway from listening to his process. And that was the thing that impressed me most in my world to kind of take back into my world and go, oh, okay. I mean, I never like to think about character as something being separate than the technique. In fact, I have a really hard time talking about those two things separately.
Character and technique.
But I know lots of people can talk about them separately, but it just occurs to me that Danny, he has integrated the two. And I wondered, what is your take, first of all? So the first question is something around this idea of, what do you think about this idea of Danny's character and his technique? Do you see them as integrated, or what's your viewpoint on that?
So I haven't thought of it like that, with it integrated or not, but it is. It's completely integrated in many ways. But I have also seen, I started watching Danny D'Ortiz, which everyone should look at his Fool Us act. Like, to be able to listen to what we're talking about now, you should just go on to YouTube and you should Google Danny D'Ortiz.
Yeah.
Ortiz, O-R-T-I-Z, Fool Us on Penn & Teller, which is a giant magic show, for those who don't know, on TV in season 12 or whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, then you will know what he does. But I've been watching this guy. I think I saw him the first time in 2012. Might have been the first time I saw a video of him.
Yeah.
And he has become I think he's become more integrated, even more himself.
I see.
I already loved him when he was doing that, and the core of everything that he was doing then, 10 years ago, is now even more integrated and even more. But he has immense technical skill.
Hmm.
Like, I remember just one of these acts that I looked at in the beginning that I loved and that I tried to do. One of the things that he did to make this effect work, spoiler alert, it's like he is doing a bunch of stuff and then he takes a card and picks it off the deck and does something. But he is picking off not one card, but picking off two cards or three cards, but picking it right off the top of the deck and picking the amount of cards mm-hmm. that he needs to do.
Mm.
Boom, picks two cards up, treats it like a double, like a one, mm. and puts it back down and does. And I practiced and practiced to be able to put your hand down and not look like you are doing. Because if you start to do fiddle around and everyone goes, oh, you're doing something and you're picking it up.
Right.
So that was just like a tiny example. But when he does it, it is completely invisible because he's all sloppy with everything. But meanwhile, when he bends over to do that, or when he does it this way or the other, or he does a four shuffle or he does whatever, then it's just completely invisible. So the skill is there. And I think he also practiced technique a whole lot.
Mm.
And then he has such a strong character and such a strong style that whatever technique he's practicing will be colored by that.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, a lot of the ways that the Fool Us Chicks seem to work is his style, in terms of he's a person who likes to touch other people. Like he physically reaches out and touches the volunteers who are next to him.
Mm.
He changes his mind a lot.
Mm.
He, you know, he changes,
starts something and then it changes it a little bit.
Exactly, yeah. In the middle way, halfway through, he changes it.
Yeah.
And those aren't just stylistic, let's say, affectations for extra entertainment. Those are literally how the effects are functioning.
But it's also, it's both, I think.
I was just going to say, along with the technical skill.
Yeah.
But it's not just he does the perfect double lift, but he reaches out and talks to you and touches you at the same time as he's hiding the card.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not just that he hides the card well, but he also does the psychological distraction.
Yeah, yeah.
You already said that he's very much integrating technique and character. But are those words that you use in your world? Do you talk about character as a separate thing?
To me, the character is one of the... He talks about pillars, and I also use that word, pillars. Okay.
Can you explain that for how you do it?
Well, I've talked about that at length on this podcast before, but like, what is the elements that builds up an act to be able to talk about it.
I see.
And it's the who, and so it's the character, somebody who is doing something, some kind of material, and that material is presented in some sort of structure. It's got something happens in the beginning and something happens in the end, and you take those choices. And the material is usually then got a whole bunch of technical stuff. That's where skills and stuff lies. Yeah. And then the structure is a little bit more sort of theoretical. And the character is a person. But a lot of the time, like when we were talking about your show, your character is basically I said character and you like put your hackles up and going, I'm not sure about this. And I'm going like, well, my character is just a juggler. And I go, yeah, well, that's it. And then that was part of the decision that led us towards making a show where a juggler is just talking about juggling, because we don't have to, if your character was a policeman or whatever. But to say that these pillars are separated or whatever, that's why I draw them in a triangle, because they're all connected together and they don't make any sense on their own. You can't just be a character that goes out. The character, as soon as the character does anything, that starts to be material. Even if it's a clown that just comes out and has no material and just goes out and somebody starts to giggle and then they look at them and then that becomes something. Yeah. Now you've done some material. So you can't just be a character, because as soon as you do anything, you're material. And just by the fact that you did that first, there's already some structure here, even if you didn't decide on it beforehand. So it's an artificial thing to separate them. But when you're creating a show or creating an act, then you can see deficiencies, or you can go, okay, this clown act here is mainly just a character who acts in certain ways, but he hasn't got any ideas of what to do. So they're like, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not, or whatever. So they improvise in this or that. So you can look at, or you can look at in your own performance that they go, and the fourth thing in that is the audience is always there. So it's character in relation to the audience and to what's going on stage, skills in relation to the audience as well as what you think is good, and the structures, like what's interesting for the audience or not. So all those things are also connected. So that's how I do it. So character is one of my pillars as well of what it is.
Great, perfect. So following on from that, because that's exactly where I wanted to go with this first question, can you pinpoint, or can you at least reflect back to when you were younger, first starting out performing, maybe all the way back, or pick an era from your from your career? Was character always so clear to you, or was that a foundational quality of your work that you would focus on or articulate?
That's kind of interesting, because there certainly was a time when I was with my dad where there was no, from 86 to 96 when we performed together, I don't think I had any thoughts about character.
Did you think your dad had a character, if you kind of at that time?
He did, but
in an overt
and I always think of my dad as a consummate pragmatist. He don't think that he took the decisions because of an artistic decision, or to some extent, it was. He wore a tuxedo, like a tailcoat, and he wore a black kind of
wide-brimmed hat,
fedora. And so he certainly had his style of what he thought it was, and he created it. But in terms of what we did on stage and how it was, a lot of it I know because he's so technically minded and loves secrets and loves to build things and whatever. The main driving force for why we did a certain trick that he had created or whatever was because he loved and still loves to solder and make things that does impossible things and all that.
Yeah.
So like that was the motivation of that thing, not the character or not necessarily exactly what the audience is going to be. So it was a different kind of, and I feel like in the beginning I had that same kind of pragmatic approach to it. Well, we're doing this show now, it's for this people or whatever. And the character was always the same. And it was always like, I feel like happens a lot with young performers, that they think that the thing that is important about them is whether or not they can do a solid reverse cascade.
Right.
Or can you do it under the leg? Or can you eat the apple and not drop? Those are the things that starts to that at that point defined me when I got into juggling, I got into the other things, then it's much more defined by my skills.
But then there was maybe a moment later on when the skills got surpassed in terms of the main motivation with.
Yeah. And the key thing that I sometimes say there is that I went to Circa Media in 1996 to a circus school in Bristol. And then when I went there, identifying as a juggler.
Yeah.
And I had been doing street shows and stuff beforehand. So I knew that I knew how to relate to an audience. When I first left Norway, first left Haugesund and went to Oslo, and I joined a bunch of other crazy fakirs and jugglers and stuff. One of the first gigs that I did with them, which is like, you get into the festival for free to juggle on the things.
Yeah.
It became clear to me instantly that I was the most competent performer amongst them.
Hmm.
A lot of them are great skills and all that, but I just realized that I had just done 8 years of shows with my dad, so I could stand in front of an audience and relate to it. And I came there being new to the game, and I could juggle and whatever, and I could work on my five balls or whatever, but instantly I kind of went, oh, no one is doing anything with the crowd. I'd done a little bit of street stuff with my dad, and I'd worked enough that I knew you need to tell them what to do. So I pulled people in and I did all this stuff that you need to do with
it. Is that an inkling then that your character start to develop there in terms of, if you would say that word, or you were still kind of basing here's my skill and that's driving
how to do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wasn't presenting it as a character, but the change of me seeing myself was like, that was one of the things, but I didn't fully internalize it at that point, I think, but it was an inkling. And then when I went to the circus school, I came there identifying as a juggler, and there was a couple of jugglers there, Germans, who were like doing their 7-club juggle. And I was like I'm going to do this 3-month circus course, because that was all I could afford from my street performing money. And I thought, I'm gonna go to those 3 months, and during that time, I'm gonna perfect my 5-ball cascade.
Yeah, right.
So, and then you come there, and these guys are doing whatever, like 11-club passing and 7-club juggle, and all this stuff. And I went,
Do you happen to remember their name? Just off
the, one of them is Thorstein.
Okay.
And I can't remember the other guy's name right now.
No problem. And do you remember who was the director of the school at that time?
Yeah, Bim Mason.
Okay,
yeah.
That's that era. I know what you mean.
So, anyway.
So you saw them doing
I saw them do their thing in the gym in there. Yeah. And I was like going, I cannot see myself spend that much time in a space to learn that, not even 7 balls, to like, it was just like where I was at with my juggle and how much I worked versus how many shows I was doing when I was doing street shows or whatever. And it was around this time then, like when I finished there, so I went into the school thinking I was a juggler, and when I left, I thought that I am a performer, because when we were doing performance classes with BIM, then I could make people laugh, and I could improvise, and I could make stuff happen in all the crazy exercises and stuff that he did. I could make something out of those things, and I could go onto the floor and engage everybody. And some of these people had been doing circus for a certain time. Some were kind of new or whatever. But when they stepped in there, sometimes it's just like a void. But I had for somebody who was like,
you were 20 then? Yeah. Wow. Well, so that shift of your kind of self image or how you would describe, you know, you said you came in a juggler and left a performer. Was that something that was an internal kind of shift of definition for you? Or did someone, or did maybe Bim or someone else kind of help you put language? I'm trying to get to the word.
I don't know. I don't think so.
Okay.
I had at that time a slightly antagonistic relationship to Bim. I really liked what he did, but I had a mohawk at the time, and he really didn't like it because he wanted you to be neutral, and we did a whole bunch of stuff with neutral masks. And so he said, it's like, oh, you need to cut your mohawk. And I don't know if it's just that that was just not going to happen. I got a mohawk by an absolute whim. We'd only had it for a couple of weeks because we cut our hair and shaved it off, me and the guy that I was traveling with at the time.
I see.
And then I arrived at the thing, and then someone told me that I needed to cut it. And as a result, I kept it for the rest of that year or whatever.
Do you have like a brief, I mean, no problem if you don't, but do you have a brief idea of where did Bim come from? Like you were saying, neutral mask and stuff. Did he come from a theater world?
I think he has an extensive education. I don't fully know like that.
Of theater. Yeah.
But then he started a company long time ago called Mama and Dada, which is like a street performing kind of thing, like Mamre, like the Mamre plays, and Dada being Dada.
Wow.
So it was real sort of abstract, weird, street-based installation kind of stuff. And at the time, I found that very exciting. And then he was I think that he was one of the guys who started something called the Natural Theatre Company as well.
Yeah.
I'm a
little bit rusty on my whole scene stuff.
But I think he did that. And this must have been like in the 80s or something like that. And they had this like crazy good cone head alien characters. And they did sort of walkabout performance based stuff at festivals and stuff. And at that time, I found that just so fascinating because that didn't exist in Norway. I'd never seen it. sort of before, and at that point I hadn't been to Glastonbury or been to any of these British kind of festivals and really seen that stuff.
I mean, just for example, the Conehead characters as a walkabout act.
Walkabout aliens would, sure. Like they have arrived, they're really naive, they don't quite know what's going on, they're gentle, but they're walking around looking and picking up stuff and walking into stores, walking through the streets, taking pictures of funny things and calling each other over to look at the dog or play with it. So it's that kind of interactive kind of style.
That's a perfect example, because here you are as a juggler who's identifying to yourself through your skills as the main reason you're in front of an audience. But here you see these aliens who aren't doing, for example, a skill, right? You could even say they were doing more a character. Of course, there was actions attached to that. But that's kind of funny, right? That you didn't look at them and go, well, they're not doing any hard tricks.
No, but it was like, I knew there was lots of things that I was interested in that weren't related to what I necessarily were doing. Because I had already, before I then went out on the street and started to be a juggler, I had already performed some of my contortion stuff and a straitjacket escape based around the fact that I could dislocate my shoulder. So the whole core concept of who I would become as a street performer and who I would become when I became the rubber man or whatever, that all was there in embryo.
Do you think that's a...
in my dad's show. Wow. But then I wasn't so interested in that because that was so easy. And it wasn't until, like, I just did that, and I did some acting or whatever, and I didn't know what else to do with it or whatever. But the juggling was really hard, and to me, the fact that I had mastered this thing that was really hard, like where it was four balls or whatever crazy skill I had at that time.
Yeah.
Like, because it was a different time. We ordered The Complete Juggler from America, and we got it, and I learned how to juggle from a book when I didn't know a single other person in the world that knew how to juggle. So I stood there with those scarves that came with that book, and I read in the book to try to learn how to juggle, and I bought these three balls from a toy store, which are super light, empty, bouncy balls, and they're like, it was a terrible thing to try to learn with. Didn't even have bean bags. It just like... And now I look back, it's like, that's why also my progress was so slow. I didn't know anyone in that, and all the other people that knew how to juggle in my hometown, I had taught.
That's funny.
Always at the top of the game.
Sure.
Until I got to Oslo and I wasn't then necessarily.
I mean, for me, that's really funny. That's a funny way to look at the world when you're young, because my experience when I was growing up in these same sort of phases of my life that you're talking about, it's that myself included and my friends, we were really only interested in the things that we were doing in terms of, you know, you were saying you found juggling engaging and just the right amount of challenging to kind of hook you into it. But you were still interested in all these other things just kind of casually, like you could do some acting and you pop your shoulder out a little bit with your dad here and there, right? I distinctly remember, you know, being aware that there were other things to do in front of an audience, but I was a juggler, you know, so that's the only thing I cared about. And I really remember going to juggling festivals, and it's still true today, which really, well, we get there, but it's really antagonizing. But like, I remember going to juggling festivals, and the second anybody on stage at a juggling festival does something that's not juggling, it's just not valid. Well, anyway, but as an example of like, hey, what am I interested in? Well, juggling. And that's it, because that's what I do. That's how I can identify with something. It's kind of cool that you had a little bit of a bigger, broader perspective.
Part of it is also because I came to performing through magic. And I came into magic because that was my dad's thing.
Right.
And then I got bitten by the thing, and we went to the conventions, and I met people and whatever, and got Max Maven's autograph, and met Eugene Berger. And
at what age was that?
So that was like...
You got Max Maven's autograph?
Yeah, maybe like 88 or something like that.
And how old were you then?
12.
Around? Wow. That's amazing.
I can't remember exactly, but...
Met Eugene Berger?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, met. I'm like an 11-year-old, so I was in the same room as him, and I saw him while everybody else was sessioning or they were talking, but I have been to a lecture with him and seen him and been thinking, man, I got to get one of those little candles to burn that thread there.
Right.
And of course, I didn't have the chutzpah or the deep voice to be able to... to do his kind of stuff. But
no, I get you. No, that makes a lot of sense.
But then doing magic first, and even then, like when I saw David Williamson and saw him use the raccoon and see people do, somebody did a chapeau, that circular felt thing, and made all the hats, and I saw
chapography.
Like, yeah, chapography. Yeah, that's like, I loved all of that stuff. Always, like, I thought that was just great. I didn't know what to do with it or how to present it or whatever, but I liked that stuff already then.
I mean, I just want to jump in and say a couple of things before.
I got into juggling because I wanted to do devil stick. That was the first thing.
Why did you want to do devil stick?
That's the only thing I wanted to do.
Why?
I don't quite know. I think I must have seen somebody do devil stick maybe at a magic convention or something, I bought one.
I see.
One there. And
cool.
So, because I just thought that it looked a bit like magic also.
Sure, sure.
At that time. And I get that. And for a long time, that was...
It kind of levitates a little bit there.
Satine's magic show, then... Yeah, it looks like
levitation. Like it levitates a little bit.
You start at the bottom, like it's flying like that. And I'd never seen it before. And it was like, oh, this is amazing. It really looks like magic.
That's cool.
So I opened the magic show, opened with that.
Oh, that's cool.
For years.
Wow.
I didn't Devil's Dick. Yeah. And then I did a little bit of balls and then a little bit of clubs.
Wow.
In a 3-minute act.
I mean, I'm in one way, I'm super jealous of your origin story there, because I have a really good example of that, which is that, you know, when I was maybe, I don't know, 15, 16, I had a couple of friends who started to branch out into different sorts of performing styles. They were still doing juggling, of course, Frodo. Come on, we're not doing anything but juggling.
We're not crazy, yeah.
But they started to...
Didn't do chapography.
No. But it was some sort of like gothic presentation. So they did heavy like black eyeliner.
Oh, yeah.
And I come from Ohio. So I painted my fingernails when I was like 16 or 17, because I had this idea of like, oh, yeah, this is just how it is in Ohio. You know, I was growing up, where it was like, well, I'm a guy, you don't paint your fingernails. But I was like, oh, but there's some sort of like visual effect with the juggling. And then because this friend of mine wore heavy eyeliner to, blah, blah, blah. And I remember my mom asking me one day when I was like 6 or 17 or something, and she said, but Jay, are you trying to be a girl? And fair enough, like with her upbringing and her, you know, the world she grew up in, and as old as she is, and you know, the age that she, where she got her, you know, values and expectations and everything, like just living in Ohio, right? But looking back on that and saying that to you now, I mean, this was in 1993, 94. And it's like, I didn't know who David Bowie was. Like, I wasn't exposed. I mean, look at what these people were doing with an androgyny and with even just like stage makeup that you would wear eyeliner even as a...
I don't know if I knew who David Bowie was at that time either. That
but looking before. Back on it and say, I mean, come on, like with his iconic, 70s. And, that was already happening in the world. But here I am in Ohio, and I think wearing eyeliner is a... extreme move, and my parents are concerned that I, you know, I'm
questioning that, you know, a guy that has eyeliner.
Exactly. No, really. And so that was kind of like the narrowness of my exposure to anything other than what I was specifically doing with performing. Whereas you had this kind of much broader origin story. And I just wanted to reflect. I just wanted to tell you
that. I think that's also just from like when you are into magic, there are magic stores.
Mm-hmm.
And magic stores. So my dad, remember one year we bought a magic manuscript, which was the Louis Tannen magazine. We got a bunch of boxes of that. And that had ads from all sorts of magic stores. So in one big session, we exchanged some Norwegian money for American notes. Mm-hmm. And because you could send $5 for a catalog or whatever, and $10 in freight from whatever. And then we sent that out to every address and got magic catalog sent. And when you get a magic catalog, it's mainly magic, but there's also the allied arts. There's some juggling equipment. There are other things, some a unicycle or whatever, like magic stores have. Some have novelties. Some also have some costumes or whatever.
Totally.
So because there's that commercial aspects to the fact that you have to run a magic store that's so narrow and you still have to make enough money, there's other things in it. So I don't know if that was also that. It was just available and it felt vaguely related to what it was that I was doing.
You said the allied arts now. Is that a term that you grew up with, or where did you hear that? Do you know?
I don't fully know where it is. But it is something I've grown up with.
Okay.
And it's like Magic used that as this magic and our allied arts, and I don't know where I have it from, okay. But I'm using it like that. Just
at
like,
least you came to that term through a magic through the magic world.
I think so. Yeah, that's where it must have come from.
No, I wonder. I'll have to go do some digging and see in the juggling world. I've heard that term before, the allied arts, and I wonder if it's a magic term or maybe it is.
I thought it was. Okay. I think it is like from a magician's point of view.
Yeah,
and a lot of people have the same attitude that you have with magic to why is this happening in the magic convention when it's not magic? This is a juggling. Usually always some variety acts, like maybe one or two.
Someone has a yo-yo fest. Or something.
Yeah.
Like what's this doing? Yeah.
And someone's like going, oh, where's the time? It's like, where's the sleight of hand? And always it's not even a double lift in this.
Oh, and also just I want to clean up one thing from earlier in the conversation and then jump back to your character. But these days when I go to a juggling festival and, you know, talking about this idea of having a broader idea of what's out there in the world, and I see someone on stage do something that's not juggling at a juggling festival, how dare you? I tend to think of myself as a human being first.
Yeah.
I'm not even a performer, but I'm just like, hey, I'm a human being. I have emotions or I have the qualities that makes me human. That's my starting point. And from there, we can move on from there, right? And so if somebody does something that's not juggling, maybe it's fine if they're also, if I can also sense some humanity, or do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But I think so too. And I think maybe it's just did a combination of coincidences through that. I mean, I'm also always been interested in too many things. And then I get very deeply interested in certain things.
Hmm.
But that's part of the Waldorf Steiner education too. It's the idea that you are there, they're fostering it, that you should, at the same time as you're working on something intellectual, you should connect to it emotionally through, you gotta use art to express, it doesn't matter if you're doing maths or you're doing whatever, you're also at the same time doing poetry and you're writing or drawing, making a drawing of some certain things or whatever, and
I see,
and
yeah,
doing something physical with your hands and interacting with it, so that's always been sort of part of it. So maybe there's an element of that as well that comes out, that I have been interested in different things. And also now I know that when I look at things, you can always, like, there's that steal like an artist idea that if you steal from one person, then it's plagiarism. But if you are inspired by 10 people and take one little thing from each of them, then it is like we talked about yesterday or whatever, where most artists, fine artists or whatever, because it's like, oh, I'm sort of doing a Jeff Koons mixed with
Damien Hirst,
Jean Miro kind of
thing
or whatever.
Yeah, this combination name, Jean of
Miro? Yeah. I remember his first name now.
Yeah, but combinations of references.
Combinations of references. And then you look at their work and some of the time you can actually go, yeah, I can see that reflection in there. And
most of the time when you have those combinations of references, the work is already done before you've seen it, because you get the...
already done. I can see what this is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Damien Hirst and Jeff Koons, got it.
Got it, done. Yeah. Ah, good idea. Okay, moving on. What's the next big thing?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to jump ahead super far.
Yeah.
But I want to connect it back to your origin story.
Because we started out with talking about Danny D'Ortiz and character and all that.
I have
that
two questions for you. We're just on the first question so far.
Oh, yeah.
Wait. So, no, I want to, because you were doing really good with the Circuit Media, and you're starting to talk about this moment when you got into the idea, a little bit discovery of like...
A character.
I'm a performer. But I want to jump ahead, because the reason I also wanted to talk to you about this, there's another part of it that kind of relates to this whole thing, and I think you're going to tie them together. Is you know, pretty recently, and I don't know if it's within the past year, you mentioned to me a little bit about you've had some success and some opportunities here and there to tell some different stories on stage. And to the point where people regularly in your life, not just in the past year, but I think for your whole career, to be honest, and maybe you've noticed it more recently, people will come up to you and be like, man, Frodo, you're just so funny and cool and crazy and blah, 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 blah. You could just do any, I would just watch you do anything, right? And confronting that, like, I want to know how do you confront that? I mean, we've talked about it before, but how do you confront that idea? And also, if you kind of think back then to your origin story of like, well, I'm not a juggler anymore. Now I'm this person who's performing. And I know that's a long gap to fill, but maybe you can tie some threads there, pick some moment out of your life to kind of reflect on this idea that now all of a sudden, Frodo, you've transcended, like, I don't even know what to say, concrete action. You've transcended genre. You've become not even just a magician or a juggler or even a performer. You've become a showman.
That's
sure.
How I think of it, though.
Okay, yeah, but to the point where other people are just like, Frodo, you can do anything on stage. I will watch you eat a banana. I'll watch you, you know, whatever. Like,
yeah, but then I always feel like, no, you just think that because you've seen the acts that I do, and the acts were really good. And then this character, and I am, though, deliberately, and I have been at least since starting to build this mythology of showman and what that is, that came out in my blog first, which came out in 2011 and 2012. For 2 years I did the blog, and I developed a lot of those ideas of what a showman was, and my ideas then would be that I could do different things, and I have sort of deliberately tried to be like a one, like. And that's rubbed off so much like that. My wife, Miranda, when I at some point talked to her about, oh, yeah, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do the show, I'm going to do a 1 hour, 1.5 hour thing, or 20 minute thing that I had to do in Norway at some point. And I said, oh, maybe I could do that sword swallow thing that's a little bit like that. And then later on, I could do that thing where I swallow it sort of completely. And her being so used to seeing soiree or like that being her only real introduction to what this is, and goes, like we've already seen that one sword swallow, you should probably do something else. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to explain, well, actually, there are a lot of people who are sword swallowers who that is the only thing that they do, and every time they come on, they do another version of swallowing a sword. Mm. But she's so used to seeing soiree, and me, when I make another act, it's something completely, it's a different skill. So she thought at that point that was kind of like what you did.
I get
but
you.
For me, it has been a deliberate kind of thing that I want to have the, give the feeling like, or like give the feeling that I am, can do anything. That was the feeling that the show wanted to have, but also then that was what I wanted to do for myself as well. So I have been cultivating that.
Exactly. That's what I was trying to get to. So when did that start in your process? Was that ever a conscious... like?
No, I think that was what I was talking about, why I talked about the blog and whatever. Because in the blog, it's like...
I see.
At that point, I was specifically interested in the shaman as the origin of the showman.
Cool. So,
it wasn't related directly to what I did, but I was thinking these highfalutin things. Well, if these are the potentials of the character or person that I am when I'm on stage, like, then I can't just be doing more bendy stuff or more whatever. Like, you need to have a scope or like a spectrum of things that happens in the show that touches people in different ways.
Cool.
And that's... Now I express all of that as the structure and character and material. Those are connected to the three main human faculties of thinking and willing and feeling. Doing.
Yeah.
So action.
Yeah.
I get you. Yeah, yeah.
So I want to ask you, so what was kind of happening right before that then? So what was happening with you around 2009, 2010, 2008, or like late 2000s? Like you said, this around 2011 and 12, you got this blog, right? And you kind of started this journey. But like, was there something now looking back that you
was bubbling up before?
Was it like bubbling?
I think part of that might be that I worked in soiree for so long and I just did those two acts.
Okay. How was that? Like, how would that... Yeah, I get you, but can you explain a little bit more about that? Just repeat what you said, but a little deeper. You said part of that is because you worked in that show.
Because I worked in soiree for so long. Yeah. And by 2012, I had worked in that show for 6 years.
Yeah.
2012 was also the year that my daughter was born.
Hmm.
But during that time, I'd just done my tennis racket act and my cans act on repeat. And by that point, I don't know if... I think it was also in 2012 where I started to push really hard and... made that sword swallowing act that I did.
But push hard to...
Push hard to get to do other material in soiree.
Gotcha. Seven. Because you were bored of the other, or not bored, but you were restless?
Because I wanted to expand. And then at the same time as I was thinking these things, reading these books.
I get you.
And expanding my mind as to what I could be doing. And then, much like I am thinking currently now, like I was just going like, oh, I really need to expand. I really need to knuckle down and make a proper solo show and try to actually sell it on the, get my name out there and put my own name on the tour and do it like we always talk about it, that work that is, I hope that is going to just blow people's minds, but that most of the time just people look at and go, ah, that was nice. I love you when you do the rackets.
right.
It's like, oh, you're not doing the rackets in this show I did in my last show or whatever. And I've had that sort of discussion where people go, oh, well, but you should do that. People love that. And I go, yeah, but I'm not taking them out because they're not good. I'm taking them out because that sets a certain standard that makes other material look
totally
in a different way or whatever.
Absolutely. Well, when you were doing La Soirée for those years, were you known, like, how were you known to the company? Were you known as a character? Like, oh, Frody's such a good character. Or were you known as, like...
Known to the company? What do you mean?
Maybe in terms of the people making the show, where they would place you or how they would talk about your act or you as a performer. Like, was there some sort of... What I'm trying to say is, I mean, you have a very identifiable style. And I just wondered, was that language that they used when they were kind of, oh, okay, we'll put Frodo here because, you know, his character is like this?
Yeah, we need a character that talks and opens up and wins them over in the beginning or whatever. So then often be Clark McFarlane or Mario, Queen of the Circus. Right. That's his character.
I see.
You need somebody, like we do a music act first, singing or something like it. Break the ice, set the atmosphere, and then we most frequently did the gents afterwards. Skill, English, high skill English gents with high skill and some semi-nudity, good-looking, extremely muscly guys. So it's high skill with great character, and then we need somebody to talk to them and directly connect with them. And that was kind of me and Clark did that. And sometimes it would be Clark straight into me, and sometimes if Clark wasn't there, then it would be me in that sort of spot. And it wasn't my favorite spot because it's a little bit early for me, but because then you got to do more work in winning them over. But
I got you.
But now when I look back at them, going like, okay, so you have Gato Chocolat doing the Sondoma first, and then straight into the gents, and then Mario doing his Another One Bites the Dust with his stand-up bit first, and then me straight after doing the rackets. It's like now that I look back at that and all these artists that I go, they're such incredible people, and that was just the first four, and then that half was closed with Ursula Martinez doing her hanky act and all that. So it's a super strong show, and I got to see more and more how the different components worked. So over those 6 years, because I was talking to Brett Haylock about acts that were going to be in, that potentially could be in La Soirée, La Clique as it was called at the time, before I was technically in the show. Because I already knew him from doing the Happy Side Show, and he was traveling with the Spiegel Tent and he was organizing that. So when I was still in Circus Oz, technically, but we'd already started to talk about me joining Soirée. We were watching the late night thing at the Spiegel Tent in Melbourne. And I think Dennis and Hamish, the English gents, who were doing street shows, had heard that you could go to the club, at the late night club at the thing, and you could come and speak to these people and they would give you $100 and you could do a gig or whatever inside and they could see. And then Brett said, Frodo, come and... We were doing a season with Circus Oz at the same time as they were playing at the Art Centre in Melbourne, and I went there and then met Brett, and then he said, oh, you should come and see these two guys. We're thinking of maybe taking them on. We're just wondering or whatever. We're going to see them do their act now. And they did their act busking where they had some cups of teas and they put their stuff on the floor. And it was like straight out of Compton, straight from the street and in. And I immediately said, we should do this. And she kept a hat rack. And some of those things that I said in that initial conversation became how their act fitted into the other show. So already from the very beginning, I had that relationship with Brett. So I was a kind of, to use Jeff Sheridan's idea or word, sort of as an act doctor. He wrote a book called An Act Doctor.
Okay.
Like when an act come into soiree and Brett needed something to happen, his personality and his mode of expressing himself is quite, can be very difficult to interpret. He speaks in kind of in with gesticulations and talks, and it's more about the vibe. And he goes, and I have get along really well with him, and we've had a long relationship that developed in me understanding what it is that he wants from the act. But sometimes what he wants and how he thinks of it or so it doesn't necessarily translate or seem quite inviting to an audience member if the producer has too many ideas of what they want them to do. So I function there like a director in those shows. And then when he made his first next production, then I was hired as in a directing role for the next show that he did, Club Swizzle, as well. So he valued what I had already given. So
I think
all of this stuff, I think, made me, I've worked with lots of different things. And this was also when I developed a lot of this language that I want to go on about material and skills and stuff. Because if I was going to talk to, so I helped with George, Gâteau Chocolat was working on one of his solo shows or one of the early shows back, and then he was talking to me about some idea, and I needed to have something to say to him, who is doing singing and a little bit of stuff in between. But and then I'm working with Nate Cooper, who's trying to get the whip-cracking act together as his second act for Soiree, and then I'm being told to jam with him on that, and then I'm working with somebody who does an aerial act who needs to fit in, who don't quite have a character, but that's got great skills, and you need to make them a little bit more. And I need to develop a language and a way of thinking about these things that is multidisciplinary. So that's where some of those things come from, so that I can talk to everybody and see what is it that's working here, what is it that's not working, or what is it that this is missing, or what can I add to these things when you're just being thrown into it by, and I don't speak the language of that particular discipline. So,
yeah, I think I had an inkling that you went through those experiences, but I didn't quite know how concretely this gave you almost a, you know, we're in this age of going from intuition to consciousness, or we're in this journey basically of gaining consciousness of what's the process, what are we uncovering here? And that's what you're just explaining now, is you kind of had all this practice and experience of becoming conscious, becoming conscious of these different qualities and these different
Different aspects of what made it work. And then also by being in a variety show, I got to see the different functions of it. And then to be in a show that was such a behemoth killer success as Soiree was. It went from strength to strength and kept like, so for those 12 years, it was just like, you came to town and seasons were sold out before we came. And it was such a, and in the beginning, it was just, it was what it was. But then after, like, the show was the artist that was in it. And then after a while, you sort of go, oh, we need to start to change this up because you're going back to the same town. How are we going to do this? And who are we going to keep? And how are we going to make this work or whatever? So I got to analyze the show a lot through there by doing, seeing it eight shows a week and watching the acts. And also then, but that second sort of thing from 2012 onwards, that was when I first started doing that sword chopping act that I wanted to have into the show. And as I did that, then was also the idea then that then we could potentially do the cans or not do the cans. But that was also, as far as I remember, it's round about then as well that Dennis Locke had started to work on Bubbles.
And really?
Me and him. So he did that.
What year was that?
I think it was maybe 2012 or 13 or something like that.
Wow.
Or
yeah.
Was it that early? Maybe it's actually a few years later. Anyway, no, it was around. It might have been. It's in that era.
Sure.
Absolutely, it is in that era. And he had been doing that mainly first to do it. Like, who's seen Tom Noddy? And Tom Noddy was in La Clique at one point as well.
Yeah.
So we.
I wanted to ask you about Dennis's Bubble Act and how you worked with him. So this is perfect.
So they worked on. So they worked together. I wasn't there then. I was in Edinburgh with La Clique when that it split up, and he would then when Tom Noddy was there, but he saw that they hung out. Then he was doing some stuff like that with when his daughter, so it must be after 2012 because both Dennis's daughter and my daughter was born in 2012. But so when you, he was doing soap bubbles with her. That's where some of those skills came from. He was just like playing around with that. And so he developed some skills, and then him having a similar kind of obsessive personality like you and me kind of have when you first get into something,
right,
to then actually go, okay, and you Google some stuff online, you look at it, then you make some different things. And now what started out as a little something that you did, blowing soap bubbles with your hands and stuff like that, with interacted with the kid in a hotel room in Darwin or whatever in Australia,
yeah,
became something. And then when Swizzle happened,
yeah,
Club Swizzle, the show that I then was asked to direct, we were doing a season in Perth already, and my dad had actually flown over to Australia to meet me, and then we were going to do some further directing on that Club Swizzle show, and he took me out of soiree for 1 week or something.
Mm.
Or maybe it was just even a weekend, I think, even. I was going over too because there was some problem putting somebody new into, somebody had gotten injured, or I can't remember exactly now.
Yeah.
But that was nice to go take we got flown over. My dad came with me and we went to the opera house. And
yeah,
that was, my dad was very proud that
yeah,
his son was flown over to direct the show, which is opening in at the opera house.
And yeah, in Sydney Opera House.
All that stuff.
Yeah.
So,
and was that when you
my dad walked on it, went on a tour? Brett organized so he could go on a tour of the Opera House, and then the Opera House tour went through the Opera House and came in. They're looking at the theaters and whatever, and they looked in, and then the guy comes in, and the guide is going like, "Oh, and in this room here, they're working on a new show from the people who brought La Clique, which is the show that has sold the most ticket in the history of the Opera House. And in here, and that guy who is there, that is Captain Frodo, and he's from Norway. Oh, do you know him?" He said to my dad, set up like a perfect joke kind of thing, because he'd gone, "Oh, you're from Norway." That had right. come out in the group, and he goes, "Yeah, that's my son." And my dad got to say that, and that was like a big thing. But anyway, now I lost the thing. I was away from Perth.
But okay.
That opened up a hole in the show because my acts are practically 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So I left. Dennis got to do in the late show, or was it both shows, had his idea of doing a bubble act. And he did a silent bubble act where I think he might have said something right in the end. And
just you didn't work
bubbles.
You didn't work with him on that.
Now it's a little bit unclear. I don't think so.
Yeah, okay.
In that first version, we must have spoken about it somehow.
Sure.
But then he got to do the first iteration of that thing.
Okay.
And it was, lovely.
Yeah.
The bubbles are just super lovely. But when bubbles pop or whatever, it was just him just doing it, and he hadn't sort of worked it out, all the details.
Sure.
And then after that, we went on a rural tour of Australia, played smaller towns or whatever. And then for that tour, we kept working on the act. I kept filming it each time, and we got backstage and we talked about it. And I said, "Oh, we got to do this." And I was like, what was the things I said? It's like, we got to have that. Even when you have a bunch of pops, the act still's got to be really good. We got to work out some pop lines, just like you have a drop line when you do juggling. Work out what do you do when something pops, so that it's got to be the what happens when the different things pop. Those things that you do when they pop's got to be so good that at the end of the act you go, "Damn, none popped. Then I've lost those laughs."
Yeah.
So that's like what we got to go. I don't know what it is, but we got to find these things. How do we do it? And how does that build if you have three pops in the show? Don't go blow everything on. Don't just go out of character and swear on the first one, because if it happens four times now, you got nowhere to go on that thing. That all the sort of stuff that we.
Well, what I want to know is
a robust act.
What I want to know is. So Dennis, I mean, he had the duo act with Hamish, the English gents.
Yes.
And so they played these very stylish English gentlemen with bowler hats and pinstripe suits in newspapers, and very refined and cultured, British gentlemen.
Pipe.
Sure. They
had a pipe in the mouth.
There you go. And so was there any discussion of, okay, now Dennis is going to get a second act, this bubble act. Does his character have to fall in line with this English gents? Was there some desire?
It was almost unspoken. It's also not unspoken, as in it wasn't even questioned. It was the English gentleman who did this.
Okay.
He speaks with a British accent, which he had originally done when they did the street show. He would speak in this sort of funny British accent, and he would have a pipe, and as we all know, a key component of doing soap bubbles is that you fill some of them with smoke.
Right. Now
the pipe, you don't have to smoke cigarettes to do that. You can get just vape things which don't actually have nicotine in them.
Right.
So you can just do the smoke where you put it into your mouth and you blow it in. And vaping things exists in pipes as well.
But when you were working with this, like you said, almost unspoken assumption of like, yep, we're going to keep this English gent character into the bubbles world.
Yeah.
And these different sort of props like the pipe and things. So did you ever, like, how intentionally then or consciously did you talk about the character then driving the, was it everything in terms of driving the pop lines or the structure of the act or the techniques?
Yeah.
It was all in line with that.
Yeah, it was in line with that. But it's also then, of course, it's like his character is also partly himself. Dennis is extremely well-versed in science and in all these kinds of things. So those things are coming through. That's also that character. And always like we're thinking we both love the kind of image of the British kind of gentleman naturalist or whatever. So
like David Attenborough.
Yeah. So he was improvising and came up with ideas and stuff. And a lot of it is just directly him doing it. Like he's coming up with some ideas. And then I would often go, that's really good, but you should probably shorten it down to a third of the size and do this little comment on the end to get a joke or whatever or so. And then for a long time, I was convinced that we should try to craft his final speech. So because he does a very complicated sort of rocket thing that flies up in the air and is a beautiful
bubble structure.
Moment.
Yeah.
Bubble structure where the bubbles get smaller and smaller with lots of rings of smaller bottles on bubbles on the side. And it's partly made with helium and partly made with smoke and air. And it's partly, and this is also finely adjusted so that it's going to move up and be in a column so that the smoke is heavy with the air. So it's heavier on the bottom and flies up into the roof, pops, and then one bubble comes down again. That's the structure of it. And then he does a little speech. And I was like, because in my act, because what the idea was that during this time from Perth, where he did the first thing where Brett basically goes, it's like, yeah, it's it looks great, but it's not quite an act yet. And that's like, so you gotta do some, and then in the end it's basically how Brett talks.
Okay.
And I go, I think I know what you mean.
Yeah.
And then we're talking, and then I go, okay, what you need to do is to give us time in the show. We can't just practice backstage. We gotta get time in the show. And then I convinced Brett that when we go on this next tour, on the rural tour, and we're doing 8 shows a week, and it was a lot of stuff. Then we go, whenever we go, then I can open on the press night and stuff, and we do the cans as the closing act. But then I want to swap out that for length, and then we can put the bubbles in the end, somewhere towards the end.
Yeah.
Or the end, and we take the cans out, and I get to do the sword swallow. So that when we come to London, we have a new closer to the show. And the idea was now that the act that he does is going to replace the cans in terms of sentiment. It didn't end up being usually the closer act of the show after that, just because of it's 10 minutes long and it's very chilled. And we needed a little bit more punch or whatever on the actual ending of the show. So it used to be then David or something.
And what was the sentiment then of the cans and the bubbles kind of shared?
Yeah, his sentiment is kind of like he wrote those things. Like his sentiment is basically like life is a lot like a bubble. It's just fragile and you just gotta seize it. Now I can't remember how we shaped it, but it's like, oh, like you just gotta seize the moment because you don't know when it's going to pop kind of thing. And it was nice from the beginning.
And just compare that with like the sentiment of the cans.
Mine is like, follow your dreams. You can do whatever you want. I wanted to be the incredible Rob Man and now I am.
Right.
Kind of.
Yeah.
There's more to it than that, but that's...
Just to compare those two. Right.
And that show was like, there was not much sentiment in that show. It was all kind of fast-paced, high, low, fast, slow, boom, but minus the slow.
High, low, fast, fast.
How about fast and faster?
Yeah.
How fast and then extra fast. It was like, everything was and then we were doing this thing, and I was convinced, because in my speech I do the final move as I am talking, so that I'm going, I wanted to be the incredible rubber man, one leg goes up, and now I am, and then the most most impossible move in my in that can act goes where the second leg lifts up without me touching it, and it goes behind and it looks like this is unnatural. And now I am, and then I just let go, and so that you get the peak of the speech together with the peak of the move, yeah, and the final image.
Yeah.
So we spent so long where I was just trying every which way to get him to be able to, while he's blowing this thing, to stop and to do the build-up of the speech, so that when that final bubble comes down from the roof, he could just catch it in his hat and go on. Because I go, what we never want to happen is that you get to the end of the act and then they feel like you've tacked on a little Jerry Springer moment, going, oh, and the moral of the story is life is really beautiful and I love you all and I live in room 304. Like, you don't want it to be this thing in the end.
It has to be integrated.
Like, that was what I wanted.
Yeah.
But then, as it became slowly then apparent, one, it's just impossible when you're doing so finely tuned blowing in this thing. And even when he then is blowing the this next bubble with the helium thing. Like, you can't talk looking at the bubble because it puffs the bubbles to move, so you can't. So, like, and we tried to do it, and him with his head on an angle looking to the side, because you've got to speak in the opposite direction while you're blowing, and it just became too cumbersome, and it made the moment of the fragility of the structure not work. And then once I got some distance and we on the actual act, you realize that it's like, with the beauty and the fragility of the bubbles, you have bought so much goodwill that it is it was totally fine. After that incredible structure goes up and that thing, the bubble comes down and he catches it in his hat and some smoke comes out and he puts it on, and then he does it's like that speech, then he just does the speech and he does one final little bubble.
There's enough to reflect on there.
Yeah.
He can take that moment.
So it actually turned out that it's like it is just the moral or the beautiful thing that you say at the very end of the act, but the nature of that act just made it that was enough. And then we had fought so hard with Brett to make sure that that act could be in and that we could test it out, and I was keeping Brett updated because he likes to know, even if he doesn't bother to pay attention to details or whatever, but I'd say what we're working on and what we're trying to improve and the timing of this and how is it going. And Brett wanted it to be 4 minutes, and I said, yeah, well, it's probably going to be like six or so, and it never went below nine, but but just to sort of say the right thing that he goes, because he's nervous that it's going to be slow and long. That's his biggest fear.
Yeah.
And I go, it is so beautiful, the minutes will not be experienced.
Well, that's the funny thing, because like when you say it hasn't gone shorter than nine, I mean, that act is not a long act, but when you say how long it is, you go, oh, that's a bunch of minutes.
It's surprisingly long, because it takes it's so slow, and then he stops and he says some stuff, and he says the stuff not on top of, we tried that too, of course, to put as much as we can, so he's making something while he's talking.
Yeah.
And some of the structures you can do that, and some of them you couldn't. But then we did all of that, and I said, this is, we have to be able to do this, and we're gonna go and do it or whatever. And then we opened in London like 1 year later, and we'd made that act in that last year. And during that press night, we got two standing ovations, one at the end of the show and one after the bubble act at the press night. And it was all like, and then the reviews were, of course, just great. And I got to do my sword act. So I didn't do the can. So we got back and it was doing the records. And then I got to do a different, completely different act.
Right. You were talking about Dennis, that his character, of course, comes from the English gents, but also that a large part of the character is just Dennis himself. And so maybe we can wrap this conversation up with one little tag onto that, and then we'll do the second question tomorrow.
Yeah.
But I'm really curious to know, and this is kind of one of the main points I wanted to get to. So you got there with Dennis. Is so for your character, how much of it is you? And yeah, I mean, in the way that Dennis's character is part of him. So. Yeah. How much is this you?
It's kind of funny, because the character that I'm most known for is the guy that's in the tennis outfit, and that's relatively it's quite unlike who I am.
Mm.
because I'm not chaotic.
I mean, that's the fun thing about you,
Frodo. Very thought through.
Yeah.
And someone was saying just the other day, it was on New Year's Eve, actually, a few days ago.
Yeah.
And some woman was there with her partner, and she said some jokes about me, and, oh, is he crazy guy, and blah, blah, and they'd seen it, and her 10-year-old son, I just loved it, and she loves the crazy things and whatever. And then I could just hear my wife going, oh, he's actually quite boring.
But I mean,
because it's sort of true, like I get now they're gone, and I'm just like reading academic things and writing and doing all this stuff,
having conversations,
like having these kinds of conversations.
Exactly. And no, but that's the fun thing about you is that you have those two different sides that you can really go into. You have this, in one way, this crazy act, and then you have this other side too that's contemplative and curious.
But that's when I watch Danny Ortiz talk, I see that in him. Like, he is a crazy guy, but then in other lectures, like in his masterclass things, he's much more organized, and he has an idea of what he wants to tell you, and he talks a lot about the same stuff that I talk about too, like what is it that the audience member is perceiving when I'm doing a triumph here, what's the effect that has on the audience or whatever. And I think that he is also not as chaotic, as brutish, as like you kind of, when you go, oh, he sort of, he says stuff in a way so that people just like name the card or whatever. Like, he's like, some of that's why people say, oh, I can't use his techniques, because every now and then he pretty much just gives them a card. And somehow at the end of it, they really genuinely swear on a hand on the Bible that they just picked the card they wanted.
Well, it's also because he has really pinpoint techniques.
Yeah.
To separate, so you the don't timing know. And to, yeah.
You don't know what's going on, and it feels completely free, but there was nothing about this moment that was free. And that's what I connect to so much, because he creates this perfect illusion of randomness and chaos, and you can do whatever you want. He goes, it's your life, you can do it.
Right.
But meanwhile, he's more or less pushing you into doing something else, and you don't feel it, because you really feel like you can pick any card from anywhere or shuffle anything at any time, and he will just go, it doesn't matter. Like, well, I don't care. He literally says, I don't care.
Yeah, yeah. Well, just to tie up a couple of loose ends, one is that you were saying that, you know, your tennis racket act, your character is quite crazy. We can say the word crazy to keep it easy. But in real life, you're not maybe so crazy. What's that moment in the act when you say, I want to talk to you about Jesus? Like, how does that go into your crazy, not crazy kind of real self versus character self?
That's like, they used to be more street bay, because that's practical. That is a generic line. Well, I don't know, but like, I don't know where I heard it or whatever, but it's a street performing thing or so. I don't quite know.
And what's that trope then? It's like you set up something complicated.
No, you're just doing something and then I think part of it is just that you say, now I want to talk to you about Jesus. That's just sort of like, it's that it jars with whatever is going on.
Gotcha.
But it's like, there was a guy I remember in when we were in Edinburgh, who then at the end, when he was doing his street show, all right, and he got a crowd, and then at the end he said, and I don't want to ask you for money, I just want to tell you about Jesus. And then in the end, we actually got him to not perform as a busker, because this was for the people who did collect money. If you were to talk for Jesus, you have to do it at another spot, because this is a different kind of thing. But anyway, so I don't know. I think I don't know if I said that line before or after that, or if it had
I've never heard anybody else say that line. No. I'm not a street performer.
So I can't remember either.
I've seen a lot.
Maybe it's not a normal line, but it's something that I picked up from somewhere, and I don't know where. But
I got you.
It's like, and then, but there was other lines like that was in my act when I first transitioned it, taking it out from the street and started to put it inside, that it had more sort of street lines, and I had some of this sort of stuff going, who thinks I can do it? Who doesn't think I can do it? And hands up if you don't really give a shit, whatever I do, as long as I hurt myself, or I don't know.
I got
like
you.
That kind of, I did that those kinds of things in the act as well, because you need to be more participatory and when you're doing a street show where you have to engage them and get them to shout.
It's a different focus environment. Yeah.
Whereas when I'm inside, you can just give the material and let them just watch you and laugh at you. Like, that's enough.
Yeah.
But so that line to me now is, sometimes it's like a little bit where it's like a moment of breath where I'm doing something completely different. it's like at the three quarters mark or whatever, or like up past the halfway mark, and you think you know what's going on in this act, and all of a sudden I bring up something else. And when I do my full 11 and a half minute, then I might do one or two or three things that are related, like three gags or whatever that are about Jesus. And it felt to me like it's just, and I do this material about Jesus, none of it, which I think is actually offensive. First, I just say that I talk about Jesus and they laugh. And then I do the thing about Easter and how he died on Easter and was born on Christmas and then died on Easter. What's the chances of that? And
yeah,
it goes into this weird thing about probability calculations and stuff.
Right.
And but that bit, you don't have to expand on that because the main punchline is just to say something else. And
I get you.
The other thing that I'm saying is just like, I was going, oh, yeah, because just like Jesus, I was also born a little different.
Yeah.
And then I use that as a link to go in, which is also a weird thing to say. And I'm not talking about Jesus, but it's really odd, but it's not offensive to somebody who is religious. Or
yeah.
So I've done that material in America a lot, and there's no one has, I've never ever heard a complaint on what I say. And even though you could see the fact that he was born on Christmas and died on Easter, since I like to think about these kind of things, we already celebrated Christmas. It's called Yule, and we did that before Jesus was born in Norway. And Easter, that the fertility things, has also been going on longer. So he did get born on places where two or whatever, if he was born on those times, it is born. So in that way you go, what's the chances of that? He was born, if I say it in Norwegian, he was born on Yule. And that Yule is an ancient word that means Christmas, from before there was Christ in Norway.
Right.
So they celebrated that there.
Mm.
And so if you dig deep and you go around, you look at it and you go, it's not religious criticism or whatever, but there's more depths and more things.
But that's you. I mean, that also explains, I mean, those words you just said also describe you as a person.
They do.
No, it's good. That was kind of the point.
But that's what that joke sort of does.
No,
it serves as a breather and something completely different. And sometimes that the fact that I do three jokes in a row without doing any physical material and no physical jokes, no skills, no slapstick, I'm just talking to them at this. It's in my mind. It's also like, it's like a mini stand-up bit where there's three jokes and some of them have tags, so it's like at the most it's like a minute or whatever of talking there.
I want one final thing is just to clarify some language just for fun. I mean, this talk about character, and you had said back when you were doing act doctor for Brett sometimes, and that this was like, I think you even said something like a really strong aerialist with not much of a character. Or you said with no character is what you'd said, actually. We can check.
Yeah.
But that's how we use language casually. And I know exactly what you meant when you said that. But just for fun, just to clean up some language would be, you know, I had a friend who was always like, oh, I saw this show and, how was the show? Yeah, they did not have a costume. And it's like, well, that's not possible. Like, they had a costume because literally whatever they had on or not is literally a costume. Like the definition of a costume is whatever you wear or don't wear during a performance.
Yeah.
What you mean to say is they didn't have a costume that you liked, or they didn't have a costume you thought was good, or they didn't have a costume that you related to.
Yeah.
So when
their choice was that, because you might have actually seen that this was the clothes that they wear every day, and that you mean that they didn't have a separate outfit
exactly
for your thing. And this was like,
but by
there's
default,
many different things that you could say
totally
that that's not what it is, but that's
but by
still
default,
ended up being there.
It's a costume.
Yeah.
And so, like when, so when we talk about, well, so when we talk about character, it's the same thing, right? Nobody can not have a character, right? Like no matter what you do on stage, it's by default your character, right?
Yeah.
Just to check. I just wanted to...
It is.
Yeah.
Like, because even if you choose not to take any choices about it, that's why I sort of, if you go, no, there's no structure to my act. I just
exactly
go out and
exactly
do whatever I feel like at
exactly
the moment. And you go, that's
a structure.
Fine. And the choice that you've taken is to have no structure. Yet, as soon as you go on, it still has a beginning and a middle and an end. Just like you can go, that was like where you look at just the clock of it. It's like, it started
when
then,
you do stuff,
this was the middle, and then something necessarily has to follow, and something has to be first. Exactly. You can't do everything at first and you can't do everything at the end. And if you go, if I just want to improvise and I do whatever I feel like in that moment, then you go, that's great, as long as you're doing this performance for you. If you're doing it for the audience, you should put thought into what's best for them. And I always use that as the main parameter or criteria, like, what is this like for them? Because that's why I'm out there. All the stuff that I do when I'm thinking or practicing or playing with ideas for acts that never actually happen or things that I could do, that's for me. And if I do it for myself and I'm practicing or whatever, then that's like, that's fine. And it's then it's a value for me. But we don't want to have what we do be theater therapy, where they are watching you having a good time or you working through some stuff. So this is why I have that shorthand of, like, this is untitled number 25. It's like, have you got something to say with this painting? Or are you just leaving it up to somebody else? Like, I just put some, I like to put paint on canvases. Then, but apart from that, I don't care. And that's also an attitude to do it or whatever. But I like it when people have thought through what they do.
Yeah, great.
More than, so.
Great, man. Well, hey, I have another question to ask you, but I'm going to ask you tomorrow after I get some sleep. But
good, good.
Thanks for telling me about your character.
Hey, thanks for asking about character. And I feel like we still need to talk about Danny D'Ortiz more and get people to see that. And the thing about the double lift that I talked about there is that it wasn't a double lift like anything that anyone who knows about double lift is, where you have the deck in one hand and you get a, you put your pinky in or you do anything. It's like the deck is lying on the table and he just uses one hand to pick that card off and he picks off the amount of cards that he wants. And
yeah, did you see the David Blaine did you see the David Blaine masterclass?
No, I watched a couple of those, but I haven't seen all of them.
You gotta watch the nail stab, because he does an effect where he's gonna stab a nail, like a real nail, just through a deck of cards.
Oh yeah.
And so first he establishes that, like, yep, I can drive with my bare hand. I can drive a nail with one thrust through a deck of cards. But then him and Ozzy, when they come up with an effect where he needs to maybe drive it down to 14 cards. And then he starts to learn how to drive a nail 14 cards down into the deck with one stab, like completely accurately. So that's like next level Danny D'Ortiz. With a nail stab. So
that's awesome.
We'll do that tomorrow.
We'll do that later.
All right, folks, that's all there is to say this week. If you would like to support the podcast, which I really hope that you would like to do, then please tell someone on social media about it. Share one of our pictures. Take a picture of your favorite episode and post it in your story on Instagram. Why not do that? You can also get a t-shirt or a hoodie or something like that. You can find the details of that in the show notes. So, it's been a pleasure having this conversation with Jay, and I hope you liked it. And next episode will be one more conversation from Helsinki. So this is all I need to say for this episode. So until next time, take care of yourself and those you love, and I hope to see you along the way.